Okay, so we are indebted to Professor Siegel for the lecture last time. He went through a lot of material, and so we're going to go back over it, some of it, from a slightly different perspective, the physical organic perspective, trying to analyze how the reactions work. He gave a synthetic chemist's perspective. Remember, he had the synthetic chemist knows they have an alkene. They want to be able to put some other groups on it. So they try to think of things they'd like to put on there, what reagent you might get, and what product you get, how good the yield is, and so on. And he told you the truth about how these things get invented. People try things. Remember, he said chemists try. And that really is the way all these reactions were invented. Many of these that we're talking about were invented in the 19th century, although there are some that are much more modern that we talk about. But I think it's also good to try to organize it in terms of just how the mechanism goes. He could have done that. He didn't want to. He's actually a physical organic chemist too. But as he said, he makes a lot more things than I do. First, we're talking about addition to alkenes, and I wanted to just show you that there's a neat resource that you can use to talk about energies. Remember, he talked about the energy, whether the reaction could work and so on. For example, the heat of combustion of four graphites and eight hydrogen atoms contained in hydrogen molecules gives 607.5 kilocalories per mole. And you can measure that with a calorimeter and then get the heat of combustion, as we talked about before, the heat of formation, the heat of atomization. But these are big numbers compared to the subtle differences that we're going to be talking about. And you have to make the measurement very, very precisely. That is, if you're within 1% in making a measurement, which is not so trivial to do, you're off by 6 kilocalories per mole, which means you're off by something like 10 to the 4th or 10 to the 5th in predicting an equilibrium constant. So you want to be as precise as possible. So often these things are found not by combustion, but by getting the difference between two compounds by doing some other reaction that gives off much less energy. So just to give you an example here, in table 10.1 of the book, there are some heats of hydrogenation. So you have an alkene, you add H2 to it, and that gives an alkane. And now, notice that what's given here is the heat of hydrogenation, not the heat of formation or the heat of combustion. So these are more than an order of magnitude smaller than the heat you'd measure in the heat of combustion. So you don't need near the same precision. For example, if you were off by 1% here, you'd be off by only a third of a kilocalorie instead of by 6 kilocalories as you were with heat of combustion. So I just thought it would be interesting to show you where you can get good numbers like that. Typically, textbooks don't have or take the time to tell you where these numbers come from, so you never really know how good they are. So an interesting place to go is the NIST, the NIST web book. That's the National Institute of Science and Technology. So if you just click that, you'll see you get NIST chemistry web book, and you click that, and so you get the possibility of searching for various things. The easiest thing to search for, pardon me, I got went back there. The easiest thing to search for is formula. Okay, so suppose we want a butene. So various isomers of butene are going to be C4H8. Okay, and let's get our units in kilocalories rather than SI. And let's look at reactions. Okay, so we'll search. And now we see we've got these various isomers of C4H8. So we could look at the difference in their energies by looking at some reaction that converts the two compounds we're interested in into the same thing. and see how different those energies are. So for example, suppose we wanted to take one butene. We could click on one butene, and here we have various stuff like gas phase thermochemistry data. Let's just glance at that. Okay, so here's the heat of formation in the gas phase. Okay, that's a pretty accurate value. It was determined in 1951. So you see it's almost the same as the energy of graphite and hydrogen, the heat of formation of this as a gas compared to solid graphite and gaseous hydrogen. Okay, so we could get that, and we could do the same thing in the condensed phase and see there are the various heat capacities, and let's see if it has the heat of formation. I'm not sure. I'm not very good at running the mouse pad on this new thing. But anyhow, these things give the exact reference for these, so you can go look them up if you want to. Derek?
Before, when it looked at the heat of formation, it said that it was -0.15 ± 0.19.
So, how did they get it so precisely?
Or, I mean, isn't that a relatively large error compared to...
Compared to 0.15?
Yeah.
I would say 0.19 is very small compared to measuring the heat of combustion, which is 700 kilocalories per mole, right? It's a hundredth of a, it's a, let's see if it's a tenth or a hundredth of a percent. It's a hundredth of a percent, right? So that's not bad. Okay, it's very hard to measure these things, but as I said, if you measure a smaller energy, you don't have to measure it as precisely in percentage terms in order to get numbers like that. So let's look instead of that at reaction thermochemistry data. So here are various reactions. Here's a reaction that converts one butene into two butene. Okay? And those values, you see, here are five different measurements made at different times. And this one, notice, was reanalyzed in 19... What is that? That's funny. It says that it's 1972, reanalyzed in 1970. You'd have to look at that and see exactly what those references made. There's some sort of error here. But at any rate, you see here's 3.00, 2.96, 3.03, 2.80, 2.75. These are pretty good agreement in these numbers, and they tell these were measured by measuring the equilibrium constant. That might be isothermal calorimetry. I think that's probably what it is. So anyhow, you can get those relative to one another. Or you probably have, here's the addition of bromine, which is one of the additions we're talking about. This tells you how much heat actually is given off in that. And there's adding HBr, adding H plus to make to the anion, right, to make this thing. That's a really pretty far out thing done by actually a graduate of this, a PhD from this department, Charles Depew, who's an emeritus professor at Colorado. And here, if we go down, here's going from one butene to cis-2-butene. Remember what the other one was going to trans-2-butene? It was 3. This says 2.54 plus or minus a half or 2, right? So it's less exothermic. So the product is higher in energy than it was before. That's the cis is higher in energy than the trans. There's adding removing iodine. Here's the one we want. So here's adding hydrogen. That's the heat of hydrogenation of one butene, right? It's -30.1. Let's see what they say it is here. One butene here. They say 30.3. So anyhow, this way you can go and see what they actually did. Here's adding HCl. So there's a source that you can use if you're ever interested in doing these, and that gets pretty close to the original data. Okay, so I'll quit that for now. So here are heats of hydrogenation. Now you notice here that cis-2-butene has let's see, here's trans 2-butene and cis 2-butene. Now, does this make sense that the cis, it says, is more negative than the trans? I don't believe that, I don't think. These heats of hydrogenation are exothermic. They're favorable, right? It's less stable to have a double bond. Professor Siegel talked about that. Less stable to have a double bond than to have an H2 than to have ethane. Okay, so minus heat of hydrogenation means it's exothermic. So this says, let's see. Oh yeah, this is right. I'm sorry, I was not thinking clearly. This says you give out more energy if you add H2 to cis than if you add H2 to trans. That says the cis was higher in energy to go to the same product, so it had more energy to give off. So it was less stable, the cis was less stable than the trans by a kilocalorie per mole. Can you think of any reason for that? Why should the cis, here's the double bond, here's cis, here's trans. Yes, Sonny? Right, these two methyl groups would bump into one another, and these wouldn't. These would only bump into hydrogen on the other side. Okay, so that seems to be here, at least in butane, worth 1 kilocalorie. Now we could do the same thing by looking at these compounds. Here's hexene with the double bond in the middle, cis and trans. And those you see also differ by 1 kilocalorie per mole, 0.9. Right, so that seems to be general, that cis is less stable than the trans by about 1 kilocalorie per mole. Okay, now here are a whole bunch of isomeric hexenes. And one reason all these things are isomers of one another. And here's their heat of formation in the gas with the error, heat of formation in the liquid with the error. How much strain energy there is calculated by molecular mechanics. And according to the source, which was this same NIST web book that I showed you, where these things came from. And you notice a large number of them came from Professor Weiberg, who talked to you last semester. Okay. So it's sort of fun to look at these and see whether these data are consistent with those for the butenes, the various isomers of butenes. You don't have to do that problem, but it's an interesting thing to do. Okay, but let's use these hexene isomer stabilities to learn something. So here are these heats of formation in kilocalories per mole. And now we see that cis-2-butene is more stable than 1-butene by roughly 1 kilocalorie per mole. And in this case, the data that I got for this, which I think was from that previous slide, the cis goes to the trans, which you can get the energy off that web book, by 1.5. I forget exactly what source I used for that. Oh, these heats of formation come from a guy named Pedley in 1994, which Professor Weiberg says is the best data available now. Okay. But you could compare this with table 10.1413, which was the one I showed on the previous slide, to see how different they are. Anyhow, that was that value. Okay. If we look at this isomer of hexene, 2-methyl-2-pentene, it's more stable still. And the most stable is the one with 4 methyls on the double bond. Now, let's see if we can understand that. We can see how much strain energy there is in these as estimated by molecular mechanics. Although bear in mind that these aren't independent numbers, it's almost certain that the data from these very compounds were used in parameterizing molecular mechanics. So it's not an independent measure. But at least the strain energy from molecular mechanics says that the cis is more strained than the trans by 1.1 kilocalories per mole, which is satisfying or obvious, depending to what extent they use this very data in order to parameterize molecular mechanics. Okay, so it's about a kilocalorie of strain. Okay, and the average would be there. So now we can look at these. There's 2.8 kilocalories of strain there, according to molecular mechanics, 2.6, 7.7 here, where you have a bunch of those methyl groups facing off against one another. So notice that the strain energy for all the ones that aren't very strained is about 2.5 or so. Although this one you might think would have as much strain as that one would, because it has two things next to one another. Although here it's methyl and ethyl, and here it's ethyl and ethyl. So maybe that's the difference. Anyhow, those are the numbers that are calculated. But if we look at these corrected for strain energy, the red lines, we see that the difference is that this has only one carbon substituted on the double bond. This has two, this has two, this has three, and this one has four. Right? So they get more and more stable as you replace hydrogens by carbon. And this is the kind of thing we've talked about a number of times, that carbon-carbon bonds seem to be more sensitive to being made stronger by hybridization than carbon-hydrogen bonds are. But here's the actual data that supports that. So if you draw a line, you can see that every time you take an sp squared CH and replace it by an sp squared CC, you gain about 2.5 kilocalories per mole as you go down here. Okay, so that's a little bit about the thermochemistry of the alkenes. Now, of course, what Professor Siegel was talking about was the addition, the so-called electrophilic addition, and he started off with adding an acid or adding free radical in a chain reaction. So the addition to alkenes. So we talked before he gave the lecture, we had talked about radical chain reactions, and we know that it goes to give the more stable radical, and then the hydrogen gets transferred, but you already know which product you're going to get, that is, which carbon got the bromine in order to give the more substituted radical. And this is discussed in the book in that section. And you don't get this other product. It's regio-specific. It'll give the one that went through the more stable radical. So not that one. It's regio. Sometimes they say regio-selective, or sometimes regio-specific. Okay, because you go through that intermediate. Okay, but then much more common for reactions of alkenes is, at least in the laboratory, is homo-lumo interactions. So now consider a possible mechanism. We have H2 and C double bond C, and we've already seen from the analysis of bond strengths, and Professor Siegel went through it, that that's going to be favorable if we could do that. To make two new single bonds at the expense of the old double bond and single bond. But if we start thinking about the mechanism of this, it's not quite so easy, because the LUMO of H2, which you'd want to mix with the HOMO of the pi, is orthogonal, and the same way for the HOMO of H2 sigma and the pi star LUMO. So you can't mix HOMO with LUMO and do the reaction as we suggested there. They're orthogonal. You'd want to trade it, but of course to get overlap, but then you have HOMO with HOMO, which is repulsive, and LUMO with LUMO, which is nothing. Okay. So that looks like a problem. And this actually is a much more sophisticated reaction than the others we're going to talk about. So we're going to put that off to talk about at the end of this subject. Okay, but that won't work as drawn. Okay. It does work if you have a platinum catalyst or many other metal catalysts, and we'll talk about that in this section later on. Okay, but then you also, instead of moving two bonds at once to make the both new bonds. You can do a stepwise, so-called electrophilic reaction, where the double bond is attacked by an electrophile, or it acts as a nucleophile attacking hydrogen in this case, to give the more stable cation, which is then attacked by the anion that we saw there. That works with any H halogen, and it's what Professor Siegel talked to you last time. Okay, and again, you get this one, not that one, because this is the Markovnikov process, because you go through the more stable, in this case, the more stable cation, whereas you went through the more stable radical in the SOMO case. Okay, now, Professor Siegel talked about analyzing this and seeing that it would be minus up in here and plus out in here, so you would expect this to act as a base. And he drew structures like this that showed that you could have an anion here in structure. But that's a little bit of the physical reality of that of this structure shown here isn't very obvious. What we're more accustomed to talking about when looking at ethylene is not where the charges are, but what the orbitals look like. Now, he was telling you the truth about charges. Okay, if you look at the surface potential of this, that's, remember, the energy of a proton when it's on the van der Waals surface. The proton is indeed happier up at the top. That's where negative charge is, so that the positive charge is happy there, 22 kilocalories per mole. But it's near the hydrogens, it's plus 17. So there's no doubt it's true that electrostatics is important in helping position fragments one place or another, right? So the proton that's going to attack the alkene should in fact be up at the top, right? Electrostatically it's better. But that doesn't make a bond. To make a bond, you have to have some homo-lumo or somo-somo interaction. So you can get the things there to react, but what actually makes them react is what I'd like to focus on here. Right? And of course we know what makes them react, that there's a low lumo that looks like that, the pi star, and a high homo. And so the high homo is what a proton would like to react with. So it turns out to be big, of course, up here at the same place that the negative charge is maximal. But that's not really why it reacts there. So electrophilic addition to alkenes is the term that's commonly used. Although as we go through, you'll see that it's not typically purely electrophilic. It's true of H+, because it has nothing else. It has no electrons, so it can't be a nucleophile, H+. So it has to begin that way as electrophilic. But other things may not have to do that, so we'll take that into account. So the textbook had already covered this in sections 316 to 319, and these are topics that Professor Siegel talked about, and we won't talk about them a whole lot more. The HX addition by a cation. He talked about the energetics of making and breaking the bonds, about the Markovnikov regiochemistry, which we just reviewed on the previous slide, and about the possibility of doing hydration, where the cation intermediate, instead of being attacked by the X minus, which was left over, is attacked by the solvent, water. But we'll talk about this a little bit. Here is what he drew to show that. Okay, so the addition of hydrogen halides is covered there in the book, and you can read about it, and about regioselectivity, because it goes through an intermediate cation, the more stable one, that explains this Markovnikov addition in terms of cation stability. And there's also stuff about cation rearrangement, so we're going to look at a couple of these topics just a little bit more here. First, with respect to cation stability, it's said that primary cations are more stable, are less stable than secondary, are less stable than tertiary. Okay, and in fact, vinyl cations, the cation on a carbon that's double bonded, is the least stable of all. So it turns out that table 10.2 is on page 445 is in the context of trying to do addition to an acetylene So if you have a triple bond instead of a double bond, and you add H plus to one end of that, the cation you get still has a double bond. Everybody, right? You used only one of the double bonds to come in here. So that's a vinyl cation. And what he says here is here's the heats of formation of some carbocations. He says the absolute value of the energy differences is not important, but the relative stability order of the various carbocations is. And he says that secondary vinyl cations are more stable than primary vinyl cations, same way that normal secondary is more stable than primary. However, it also shows that even a secondary vinyl cation is not great. It's really bad to try to form vinyl cation. So it's hard to add a proton to acetylene compared to adding it to ethylene. But now when we look at this, what's shown is the heat of formation for these various cations. I don't have the clicker here. Compared to what? What are we, when you have these heats of formation, let's assume them to be accurate. Is this giving what we're interested in knowing about these cations? What are the, is that we're interested in how easy is it to form a cation from the starting material, the alkene? Right, so we have the alkene, we're interested in how easy is it to add a proton. So what are we interested in the heat of? We're interested in the heat of bringing that proton up, maybe at the transition state or maybe all the way to get the cation, since it's going to be uphill in energy. It'll be uphill in energy to form the cation. I'm not positive about that. Whether it's going to be an early or a late transition state. I think it'll be late-ish. But at any rate, these are equilibrium values, so between the cation. But what are we comparing the cation with the alkene plus proton here? Or what are these numbers compared to, the heat of formation? It's compared to graphite and hydrogen, right? So these numbers are not the relative ease of adding to the alkenes, because the alkenes don't all have the same, the starting materials don't all have the same energy, right? In fact, they're not even isomers of one another, right? So these will have quite different, so these numbers, while not totally irrelevant, are not what you're interested in. Although you can find ones here that you can be interested in, like this normal butyl cation, and isobutyl cation, and secondary butyl cation, and tertiary butyl cation, this one, and this one, and this one, are the same elements, right? They're isomers of one another. So their difference in heats of formation, 203, 183, 165, are indeed relevant to what we're interested in, right? So you see that the tertiary one, has all these are up in energy because they're a cation, a very unstable kind of thing compared to the elements in their standard state. So this one is up by 165, this one is up by 183, and this is the least stable, it's up by 203. So that this one is by far the most stable, tertiary, more stable than secondary, more stable than primary. But as far as talking about a vinyl cation here, that's almost irrelevant because it's a completely different set of atoms. But at any rate, tertiary, secondary, primary is right. And he's right in the point he's making that it's hard to make a vinyl cation, but these numbers aren't the ones that are, would be the best to do that. And in fact, another textbook gives this as the heat of formation of isomeric butyl cations. So it gives the heats of formation, right? But it also gives their relative energies to one another right here. And it treats only these isomeric cations and includes the isobutyl cation, which is another primary one. But you notice that this primary cation, both of these are primary, but this one is more stable by 4 kilocalories per mole not as big a difference as it is when you go to secondary or tertiary, but these are both primary. And the reason may well be that there's more of the rest of the molecule is closer to the charge. So it's like solvent getting around the charge and stabilizing it. Or it could be hyperconjugation as well. But even this other book didn't give the source of these numbers either. And you see here that the primary to secondary is about 21 kilocalories per mole versus about 2.5 for the alkenes. Remember, we started off talking about alkenes. How much difference does it make to put a methyl group instead of a hydrogen on the alkene? It was about 2.5 kilocalories apiece. Here it's 10 times as much. It's much more important for the cation than it is for the in the gas phase than it is for the alkenes. Okay, now, this is an interesting example. It's from chapter 10, where here we're doing the addition reaction of HCl to an acetylene. So they say you do it at 25 degrees. The proton adds to generate a vinyl cation, right? And then the chloride left over adds to the cation to give this product. And notice it could be either Z or E. The chlorine could have been on this side or on that side. And it turns out that it's 60%, they say here, but they don't tell you what the 40% is. I don't know whether the 40% is the other isomer. I doubt it. I think the 40% is something completely different, but they don't tell you. Okay, at any rate, most of the product is, it tends to add opposite across the triple bond. Okay. Oh, I'll keep clicking here. Now, notice that the product is, in this case, this was added to a different acetylene, which just had H here at the beginning, right? But now, having added HCl the first time, you can add HCl again because this is an alkene, right? So you can get H plus add here, cation, and now you can put a second chlorine on, so 2,2 dichloropropane. Or you might have imagined that you could add the H here and get this cation and get 1,2 dichloropropane. Now, which one would we expect to get? He tells us you don't get that one. But why? What do you say about why it should go this way rather than this way? Yeah. Right, you want to get the more stable cation. Okay? Now there's something funny here if we can think about it carefully. The first thing we said that a vinyl cation is very bad. So it's slow to do the first addition to form this stuff. An alkene is much better to add, okay? Now, if that were true, then you would never stop here. Right? If the second addition, the addition to an alkene, is very easy compared to the first addition to the alkyne, then you wouldn't stop. You'd get it, but the product would react much faster than the remaining starting material. So you'd go all the way to the product. You wouldn't stop. Okay? But in fact, you can stop. Here's starting with propyne, adding excess HCl or HI. You get a 56% yield under the conditions they talked about here in the case of chlorine of the alkene and only 40% of the dye addition. Although they're using excess HCl, there was plenty of that. How come if alkenes are much more reactive than alkynes, can you stop here? See what I'm saying? So, can you see anything that makes this a special alkene? That means even though this is slow to react, this might be even slower to react so that it can stop there. Dennis? Now, what effect will the lone pairs on the chlorine have? Remember, the rate-determining step is going to be adding a proton to generate a cation. And in the previous slide, we showed that you add the proton. When you add a proton to this, you add it to this carbon to generate the cation here, and then the second chloride will come there. So this is the product you get, not the one that has 1,2 dichloride. Okay. So we said you get the more stable cation. It's more substituted, yeah. And how about the unshared pair? Does it help form the cation here? When the proton adds here, or does it hurt making the cation there? You said there's a lone pair on chlorine. What effect will that have? How does the lone pair on chlorine enter into the stability of the intermediate you're going to get, the cation intermediate? Is it good for the cation or bad for the cation, having a lone pair next door? Right? Yeah, you'll get a resonance structure where that high HOMO of the chlorine gets stabilized by... It's stabilized already here. There's a pi star orbital that stabilizes these electrons, but it's ever so much more when it's a cation there. So the chlorine helps it form this one. Okay? The chlorine helps it form this. Even if you had a methyl group on both ends here, so both of them are going to be secondary as far as, still it would go here to be next to the unshared pair. Okay? But this seems nuts. If the chlorine is helping out in forming the cation, then that should make the reaction go faster. Is everybody with me on that? If the chlorine is helping form the cation here because its unshared pair is getting stabilized, then the reaction should go faster than a reaction that doesn't have the chlorine there. Mike?
Why doesn't it make it go slower? Because if it's stabilized, then you need to have more activation energy to reach the intermediate.
No, the intermediate cation, when there's a chlorine there, is more stable than it would be if you had a hydrogen there. Because the electrons, as you go from the starting material to the intermediate, the cation, those electrons are getting more stable, the unshared pair on the chlorine. You can draw a resonance structure that stabilizes the cation with a double bond from carbon to chlorine and the positive charge on the chlorine. That is, the unshared pair on chlorine is being stabilized. Okay, so that should make the reaction faster. Can't hear very well. Aha! The chlorine is doing two things. The chlorine, through the sigma bond, being electronegative, is withdrawing electrons. Right? That makes it hard to form a cation if there are not many electrons there to begin with. Right, so that's the chlorine through the sigma system is slowing the reaction down. So it makes the alkene less reactive. So this is a less reactive alkene than a normal one. Therefore, it's even less. And what we observe is that it's even less reactive than the propyne. So you can stop part way along. Right, but if a proton is going to, so the proton has a hard time reacting with the HOMO. The HOMO is lower in energy because the chlorine is withdrawing electrons. But if you're going to add, at least get some good out of the pi electrons on the chlorine. So if you're, it's hard to add to this double bond, but if you do it, add to this carbon, so that at least you get that stabilization from the unshared pair. So it's really subtle, right, that the chlorine is doing two things. One thing through the sigma system and destabilizing the cation, and another through the pi system to stabilize it. So it would have been hard, I think, a priori, to guess exactly how this will come out. But just the fact that you can stop here, but the ultimate product has the two chlorines on the same carbon, tells you this about chlorine, that it's deactivating through the sigma system, but it orients as if it's stabilizing the cation. Sharif?
Is it because I is less electronegative, you get less yield of the two ion?
Yeah, one would like seeing this. You know, this is another interesting thing about the point of view of a synthetic chemist and a physical organic chemist. Right, from a synthetic chemistry point of view, it's a big difference whether you get 56% yield or 35% yield. You double your profit. Don't have to throw so much junk into the waste stream, right? So this is a big difference for a synthetic chemist. But for physical organic chemists, it's a fairly subtle thing. It's not many kilocalories per mole will make it twist between those two things. So I would be reluctant to interpret this too far, and I also wonder how much it would change from one experiment to the next. For example, it depends on how long you run the reaction, because clearly this can go on to the product, right? That's what happened, but not all of it went on. But if these two didn't run the same amount of time, this stuff is building up from this as the reaction goes on. So I'd want to look very carefully before I started trying to interpret these in any detailed way. See what I mean? Okay. Now, about the addition of the proton to the double bond, to the HOMO. Okay, you could imagine the vacant orbital coming in and overlapping like that. Okay? But you could also imagine it overlapping just at one end and getting a cation at the other end. Or obviously vice versa, right? So we can think of all different positions that this proton could be above the alkene. It could start here and move across to the middle and off to the right. So we could draw a curve that would show the energy as a function of where the proton is. And now we have an interesting question. Is it a double minimum such that the proton tends to be on one end? Or is it a single minimum that the proton in the middle in this ring structure is the lowest energy structure? Okay? So let's look at it when it's on one end and calculate what the energy would be and look at the orbitals. This one is what's shown above. It's the orbital, which is the pi orbital, right? But it's distorted by having the proton there bonding to the electrons in that. So this is a mixture of H plus and pi. It's the one shown on top. What's that orbital? Which turns out to be the LUMO. That's the difference of those two. Right, it's the sum and the difference of H and the pi orbital. So this is the sum of the two, and that's their difference, and a little bit distorted. Okay. Now, if we do so, if we try to see the same thing in resonance structures, there's that bond. We can see it as a resonance structure which has H plus, or as a resonance structure which has the H attached to the other carbon and the plus on the adjacent carbon, which looks pretty nuts. I agree. Okay, so or we could think of it as a Y bond, where that pair of electrons that's in the pi orbital is being used not only to bond the two carbons to one another, but also to bond each of them to the hydrogen. Okay, and this is the one that we're looking at in those resonance structures. Okay, and that, notice, is hyperconjugation, the mixing of the CH bond with the cation next door. Incidentally, hyperconjugation is can be very important when you have a vacant orbital here, a cation orbital and sigma electrons. It tends not to be invoked nearly as much when you have a high HOMO here and want to use the sigma star orbital here. So some people use that on the exam, and I didn't give quite full credit, and I don't know where you got that. So somebody should tell me where they got the idea that hyperconjugation was a big deal in acidity. It's a big deal in the stabilization of cations, or can be, but not in the stabilization of anions usually. Okay, so here's the structure you'd have for the hydrogen being in the middle, and that's what the HOMO would look like. But it turns out that that's calculated to be higher in energy than the minimum, than the one with the double minimum, and there's the LUMO that goes with that. So in fact, when it's hydrogen, it's not good at bonding with the two atoms at once. It's better to bond on one end and then have hyperconjugation. So for hydrogen adding, it's a double minimum. It goes to one end and doesn't give the Y bond. But the Y bond is not, it is, there's something good about it. It's not fantastically high, which means it's easy to get over the barrier to go back and forth. The localized cation, the one with the charge on one end or on the other end, is lower in energy than the delocalized cation, where the charge is spread over all the atoms. So it's localized. But this is low enough in energy that you can get back and forth and have a rearrangement by shifting the hydrogen from one way to the other. So we get cation rearrangements because of that. Now, if instead of a proton, you use a methyl group and do the same calculation as to be on one end or the other or in the middle, then it turns out that it's indeed a single minimum, that the lowest energy is with a bridge structure for the methyl bridge thing, which is cyclopropane with an extra proton on it. And that's what hits HOMO, and the LUMO is sort of weird here. Let's not talk about that. Okay. Now, what happens if you don't have ethylene, but an unsymmetrical double bond? So methyl's on one end, and then the double bond. So now these two things are not equivalent to one another. And now it turns out that the structure looks like this. Right? So this is the lowest energy structure. But this is higher in energy, and it's not surprising. The same factors which make this cation, which make the tertiary cation as opposed to the primary cation stable, operate to make this arrangement more stable than that arrangement. But now it's no longer a single minimum. The lower energy structure is over here. So it's a subtle thing whether you have a bridge structure or a localized charge. So there's what the HOMO of that one looks like. Forget that LUMO. I just put it in because I calculated it. Okay, and this means that it's possible to get rearrangements because it's possible to move these things across the middle and to go to give the more stable cation. So, for example, if you add HCl to this, you'll add to get the more stable cation, put the proton there and the charge here, right? But the product turns out to be 17% of what you would expect, putting the chloride there, but 83% of the chloride here on this carbon, which originally had three other carbons on it, and that carbon has moved over here. How so? It's because when you put the proton and get this, then this carbon can shift with its electrons. So it moves with its electrons over here and leaves the cation here. Now this is favorable because these two cations, this one is secondary, this one is tertiary. So it's like what we just showed on the previous slide, that it's not symmetrical, the double minimum. It'll shift over to give the one that's the more stable cation. So you get, so some of it reacts before this shift takes place, and that gives 17% of the product. But 83% of it gets over here, and then when you add the chloride, you get this. So there's an interesting problem in the book that I'd like you to look at. So do problem 9-11 about ring expansion. I don't really care whether you write it on paper and turn it in, but look at it, because, and the answer's there anyhow. But it's a, or is the, no, I think the answer's not there, but that would be a good one to discuss in discussion groups. Okay, now, we've been talking about HX addition. Oh, but I've been talking too long, so I'll quit there.